What's up, Internet, and welcome back to the Engadget Podcast. I'm Senior Editor Devinder Hardware, this week joined by Deputy Editor Nathan Ingram. Hey, Nate.
Good morning, Dev.
Good morning. Also, Podcast Producer Ben Ellman is here. Hey, Ben.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning. And this is post-Apple Review Week. It's that glorious time when our reviews are mostly done, in the process of being finished, and some of them are done. And we're specifically going to talk about the MacBook Neo and some of the hardware we saw over the last week. Since Apple announced it last week, that all happened very quickly, didn't it?
Yes. It's last Wednesday
I was in New York then. Wild how time works. But yes, I really like the MacBook Neo. I'll talk about why Nate reviewed the iPad Air M4, and he's in the process of reviewing the M5 MacBook Air. So all fun new machines, all great new Apple hardware. Have to say, Apple really put the smack down on PC manufacturers this year. Like, I need to start talking to people and just see what they think, because, wow, what they did with the Neo is wild. Joining us later in this episode is also going to be Roberto Baldwin from SAE International. He's going to talk about EVs, the state of EVs today, as gas prices explode because, war. War in Iran, thanks to many strategic decisions made by our government. So, fun stuff there, but Robbie's always a fun chat as well. As always, folks, if you're enjoying the show, please be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Leave us a review on iTunes. Drop us an email at podcast@engadget.com. And you can join us Thursday mornings around 10:30 a.m. Eastern for our live stream. Love to see you there. We can show off some gadgets. In fact, I should be showing off gadgets if I can find the MacBook Neo. Nate, it is Apple week. So it's wild, the sort of like, it's like a wave form of work that we have to do for Apple. It's the pre-Apple event, it's the Apple event, it's the post-Apple event, and now we're in the afterglow of reviews and also almost finishing reviews. You checked out a couple devices, but I want to get started with the thing I think everyone has questions about, and that is the MacBook Neo, the $599. Yeah, ultra.
About the wave, though, it's funny because like this time it was like multiple days. Like there's news on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday.
It's rising. It's a rising wave. Yeah, it's a rising wave. Oh man. But yeah, so many questions about the MacBook Neo. I kind of joked last week, like, is this the one? Is this like the ultimate cheap laptop for a lot of people? But I do have to say, like, I think my basic thing, my headline is the MacBook Neo puts every $600 Windows PC to shame. And that's pretty much it. This thing is $599 with a good screen, a great keyboard, a very usable multi-touch trackpad. It's not haptic like the other ones, like the other MacBook ones. It is like a old school mechanical one. But even there, they did the thing where it's clickable everywhere. And if you'll remember old school Windows and cheaper Windows trackpads, they're often typically only clickable in their like lower half or lower thirds. They're not like fully clickable. So Apple did that great. The speakers don't sound awful like they typically do. The webcam's 1080p sounds good. Performance is solid, even though it just has an A18 Pro processor and 8 GB of RAM. I really tried to stress the RAM on this thing, Nate. Like, I had dozens and dozens of tabs. I had multiple apps. I had games going. And I think what Apple's doing here, it both has faster RAM than typical Windows system because its unified memory is built onto the system on a chip. It's built onto the A18 Pro, so it is faster to get to the CPU, just faster bandwidth in general. But also, they're making a lot of use of like just big-ass page files. So those are like blocks of storage on the SSD where it's putting leftover like overuse RAM stuff. And the SSD.
You mentioned the games. Did you try anything? I'm sure you mentioned in the review, but I'm like, what did you?
I tried Oceanhorn 3. Yep. And that was just released on the Apple Arcade. It looks good. It has ray trace lighting. Like, it's a really nice looking mobile game that will look good on iPad. It looks good on Macs. I did try Lies of P, which is a big game, like a big AAA game meant for like the M series Macs. Didn't launch at all because that was made for M series chips. It was wild to me that I was able to install Lies of P on that system and even get it to run. Like, I feel like there should be some sort of gate to be like, hey, buddy, don't even try this.
Stop. That's interesting because they do. I've been reviewing the Air, I've been installing some games, and yeah, most of them are like, it has to have M series. And I know that like it might look like an M series, right? Because of the way their architecture is consistent, but it's not, obviously.
Very much not an M series in performance. But you know what? It's good enough for productivity apps. It's good. Like, it's certainly better than any performance I've seen on $600 Windows laptop. So I'm just like endlessly wowed by this thing.
You're not playing Lies of P on a $600 Windows laptop either.
No, so. you're certainly not. Maybe not on a $1,000 Windows laptop. So I'm just like really, really impressed by this thing, by the fact that they were able to keep the price at $600. I was expecting $700 to $800. Not groundbreaking performance, but good enough for most people. The 8 gigabytes of RAM didn't feel super limiting, although I think, hey, if you want to do like actual media editing and other stuff, then get another. The MacBook Air is still there. The MacBook Pro 14 is a great option too. You just have to pay more for more power. What are, like, based on what you've seen, Nate, and these initial thoughts, how do you feel about the MacBook Neo?
I mean, the fact that they pulled it off is pretty interesting to me. You know, it's not that often that we see like major changes in this kind of stuff, right? Like, you kind of know what to expect from a $600 computer or a $1,000 computer. And the fact that they're kind of changing that up and that the A18 and the 8 gigs is enough to do, you know, 75% or 80% of like what most people will do on a laptop is really quite cool. You know, like, I've been using the Air and the Air M5, and obviously like that thing has power to spare, which is great. And, you know, for speaking of games, like, I played Cyberpunk 2077 on it, and it isn't as nice as it is on a PS5, right? But it runs at solid 30 frames per second the whole time. No stutters. It looks pretty. It's smooth. So, like, for people who aren't hardcore gamers but want to try some games, like, totally, totally viable. But back to the Neo. Yeah, I think the only concern I have with it really is like the longevity. Like, how long will 8 gigs be enough? How long will that processor be performant enough? Because, you know, the web is surprisingly resource hungry, right? Like, people will put Chrome on it, and Chrome is notoriously hungry. So, you know, that'll be the thing. We're talking about whether or not it'd be enough to last someone through like 4 years of university. And my guess is probably not. But it kind of, again, depends on like what you need to do with it. If you're just going to be like taking notes and writing papers and browsing the web and, you know, FaceTiming and messaging and stuff, like, it might be enough.
It might be like,
there, Nate, that few... was my question of whether or not it could get you through like a whole college degree. I have my answer for why it might not. I want to hear yours first.
Yeah. I mean, my answer is just that you're already starting from behind a bit on the performance curve, so it's just not going to be as performant for as long, or you'll run into like the one or two or three things that you want to do that really stress it out.
Even, you know, storage, like, storage is an issue. It starts with 256, you can bump up to 512, but that's not, in the grand scheme of things, if you're a college kid, you're probably juggling some work school files, but also maybe play files, maybe something else, who knows, videos, music, whatever.
Yeah, I was thinking back, and it reminds me of, in, I think it was around 2010, I got an iMac, and it only had 4 gigabytes of RAM, but more crucially, it had an old school hard drive. And so within a year or two, the combo of those two things meant that it was always hitting the drive and being so slow, and even upgrading the RAM wasn't enough to get over the barrier of that, that hard drive. In this case, it might be that the barrier of 8 gigabytes of RAM that you can't touch is going to be too much.
So that gets into what I was thinking, which is, we don't know where AI apps are going to go. The thing that can get you through like just some word processing right now, what if there's some new killer app that comes along and 8 gigs of RAM is just not going to be enough for it?
Well, then it's like, this computer costs you,
because it's not going to be like totally optimized at the very beginning of its lifespan, this hypothetical app.
This computer costs you $600. So if it's obsolete in 2 or 3 years, you replace it, right? Like, it's less of the commitment that old school laptops were. So I feel like even if the lifespan is maybe 2 to 3 years, more realistically, you upgrade, and then you upgrade to something that you really need, right? Are your needs that you need more storage, you need more RAM, you need more power? Then you go on from there. I think what it succeeds at, like, it's the entry level. It is genuinely the entry level Mac. It's the Mac for new users. It's the Mac, I think, for Windows users who are kind of fed up with that whole platform and sort of just not great hardware we see from a lot of Windows PC makers, like even freaking Dell, who I typically like very much, but has made some dumb moves recently, and their flagship XPS 14 It's like, I think you should leave. I want to keep where that works. I want a car where the steering wheel doesn't fly off. You know, like that's all. That's all you have to do. Yeah.
But to your point about entry level or you know, first time buyers, I think that's actually a perfect point, is that you're either going to be somebody who's in their teens in high school and it's your first laptop, or it's going to be for people who are, older or slash know they have limited needs, right? Like they don't need to push it. So it's going to be, I think, those two sides of things. And with the first group, the people that you get it when you're 12 or whatever, and then by the time you get to college, you get an Air, or it'll be kind of the first step, but then you'll get one that's more performant or meets your needs better as you kind of grow into that, right? Like, oh, during college or during high school, you get into photography or videos or whatever. And then you're like, okay, next time I get one that's more powerful, that kind of thing.
It's very much baby's first Mac, you know, and I've heard not just from entry level
Fisher people, Price.
Yeah, exactly. But people who are like, I have a desktop at home or something, like I just want like a little thing to take out and type on. It also does the thing where it's like, well, it's not so powerful that you'll be distracted to do other stuff on this computer. If you just want a simple machine to do your writing on or to take notes or just like do basic work, like it is limited in ways that are kind of useful. So I think that's all pretty cool, honestly.
Aaron, our editor-in-chief, was saying he was like hoping before it was announced that it would be just like his cute coffee shop laptop. Like he's got a big PC at home and he just wants like something little and, good enough to like take out with him that also has a color.
Basically, it has a color and the keyboard is good. It type good. It trackpad's good. Like the screen is shockingly great for this price.
Yeah, I meant to ask you about the keyboard, because I feel like in your first impressions, maybe at the hands-on, you were a little less enthused about it.
And the hands-on, maybe it was just the demo, I was playing with. The keys felt a little like wobbly and not really sturdy, but the one I'm reviewing, and it seems like the stuff that's shipping, they feel no different than like the MacBook Air. They feel like solid keys. Wish there was more travel, but they're responsive and I can type really fast. Like I'm 90 to 100 words per minute, right? So when I go hard typing on something, like I can tell like when it just feels like sloppy or something, and this feels solid. This feels like I just sit there and write and not think about the issues like I do on the XPS 14. God damn you, Dell. How did you screw that up? So it's stuff like that.
Have they said anything about that?
They say, hey, they saw the issue I pointed out. They're going to deliver a firmware fix and we'll see. We'll see. And other reviewers, I think even Gizmodo pointed out like, hey, this keyboard seems weird. That there's weird like error correction issues or something going on here. So anyway, MacBook Neo keyboard that works, I think just really interesting, and also just makes a point like Apple has a really solid lineup right now, right? Like it is just, you start at $600. Yes, it's limited in specs, but whatever, for a lot of people, that's fine. Certainly better than the Chromebooks my daughter is bringing home from school to do her digital work. For older folks, I do recommend, you got to think about screen size. You really have to think about screen size, because this is not just like me being ageist. Like your eyes degrade after 50. Everybody's eyes degrade after 50. So for my parents, who are not even that much older, like they're 65 plus at this point, like they need 15 inch screens. I cannot give them a 13 inch screen in laptop. You can always blow up the text or whatever. I think for older folks who want to get into the world of Macs, the 15 inch MacBook Air is a much better choice and will probably last longer.
I didn't think about that when they released it a few years ago, but that is smart. Having another good reason to have an affordable larger screen.
Exactly. And that's semi-affordable, right? That's like what, 1200, 1300 now, but it's like,
compared to the 16 inch MacBook Pro, which nobody can buy unless you're using it for like making money.
For sure. So
I want to bring in a couple of comments from the YouTube chat. One from Wes Jackson asking, did Apple say how long they'd be able to support the MacBook Neo with macOS updates? Usually they do that kind of after the fact, right? Like they will eventually say like, Gen 1 MacBook Neo is no longer supported.
Yeah. It's usually like 6-7 years, right, Nate? Like in terms of Apple lifespan?
6-7?
I think
six, seven. Don't say that like you know what it means, Ben. Don't. Stolen valor.
When Devinder says like you know what it means, he means like you're 9.
Yes, exactly.
We're kind of in uncharted territory, though, right? Like the M1 MacBooks are still getting updates. And obviously a phone with the, I think it was the iPhone 16. So about a year and a half ago was the first one with the A18 Pro. and that'll get updates for iOS for, you know, 5 or 6 years. But we don't have a precedent for an A series chip on a Mac for how long that'll be viable for Mac OS updates.
It's true. It's true.
I think that they will probably be, they will push it as far as they can, but it wouldn't surprise me if it was less.
And also, like, isn't the whole idea of, like, why Apple is dodgy, maybe dodgy isn't the right word, but, like, they don't say, like, oh, we intend on supporting this for, like, X number of years. It's because, like, yes, the hardware stays the same, but also they're doing development on, like, the macOS side, and they're trying to see how far they can make macOS reach down into, like, these really old, at the time, specs. And eventually they'll be like, oh, well, we can't do it anymore. And that's when we will announce that first gen MacBook Neos are no longer supported.
I don't believe that Apple is up to anything sketchy with software updates at this point. They support stuff for far longer than I think is even reasonable sometimes. So
I didn't mean to say that they were being sketchy. I meant to say that they weren't even trying to be coy. It's just they don't even know, because they are actively working on macOS and seeing how old the silicon they can make it run on in the first place will be.
You gotta, well, like, a lot of these arguments are also coming from folks. I've seen a lot of things like, oh man, this thing is so limited and it's not going to last 4 years and yada, yada, yada. It is a $600 laptop. It is $600. The fact that this hardware exists at this level, very good. If this thing lasts you 2 or 3 years, I would call that a freaking accomplishment for what this machine actually is. And historically, you have to look at historically what Apple does. Their stuff lasts. I have a 2018 era iPad. The screen is cracked, but still going strong. It may not get the latest version of iPad OS, but it works. It streams video. I can repurpose that in all sorts of ways. When you see companies like, especially like Google and like the Android folks who are like, oh yeah, we're going to support these devices for 5 to 7 years. Your device will not work. The hardware will have fallen apart within 3 years. So please don't. That is like a real, like, oh yeah, we are so noble because we will support this hardware for so long. Yeah, make the hardware better. Make it just, like, work better.
Yeah,
but I mean, anyway,
I also produced this podcast on a 2012 MacBook Pro for several years.
Yeah, so you should bring that up every time.
And remember, this show started or restarted in 2019. So. Yes.
It was still a pretty aged laptop at that point. But anyway, MacBook Neo, it's good. Go check out my review. I'm going to hopefully put up some more TikToks, because apparently the initial hands-on video just keeps living on TikTok right now. So I have thoughts about it. Yeah. Nate, you reviewed the iPad Air M4.
Reviewing a pair of Airs. I did the iPad, which there's not a lot to say, because they've actually been really aggressive about putting new chips in that every year. Like, it's been less than 2 years since they released the M2 Air. Now we're on the M4. Aside from better chip, they have added more RAM, which is nice. And then I think it has, like, Wi-Fi 7. You know, that's about it from a specs standpoint. So, you know,
that's
the Air
powerful
continues
for an iPad, though. Like,
it
incredibly
is, absolutely.
Powerful.
Yeah. I think that the M4 iPad Pro, which also came out 2 years ago, had the M4 and 8 gigs of RAM, unless you bumped the storage way up, and then it became 16. So, you know, in some ways, this is a little better specs-wise. Super performant, very smooth. I was playing Control. They're releasing Control for iPad OS pretty soon. I got an early build of it, and it runs pretty great. So speaking of, you know, good gaming experiences there, my only quibble when I was reviewing it is that a year ago I was like, it would be nice if they upgraded the screen. And the iPad Pro has, like, a wild, you know, dual OLED tandem display, which, like, is incredible and probably the nicest screen in my house, honestly. The iPad Air is still stuck with, you know, your basic kind of, like, liquid retina, 500 nits brightness, 60 hertz refresh. And I was like, I get they're not going to put this level of OLED in a device that costs as much. That's fine. But there is an intermediary. They could do mini LED, which they did on the iPad Pro in, like, 2021, 2022, before they went to the OLED. So, like, you'd still get, you know, better contrast. you know, higher refresh rate, etc. But it wouldn't be, it still wouldn't be as good as the Pro. You know, I'm not surprised. Historically, Apple will try and like stretch their tech as long as possible before giving it the upgrade on the kind of like more, you know, middle class products. So we'll see. But that's my main quibble. But other than that, I think it offers clear benefits over the base iPad if you want to do anything more than just kind of your basic browsing and watching movies and stuff.
For sure. For sure. I would. This is the thing I keep saying, though. Like, if you like those specs from the iPad Pro, go look at the used iPad Pro market because they're around. I'm seeing M2 iPad Pros for $759, and for that screen alone, which is, it's an iPad. You're sitting and holding a screen often inches from your face. That screen investment kind of matters more than, you know, the how many people are going to be playing Control on this thing? How many people are going to be doing hardcore work that's stressing that chip? I would just say get a refurbed.
Yeah, an M2 or M3 at this point is still, I guess they don't have an M3 Pro, but regardless, yeah, you'll get a lot out of an M2. It doesn't have the tandem OLED, but it does have the mini LED, which is, again, like really, really nice.
The iPad Air is a strange beast, right? Because
it is a little.
I have often been thinking I should probably get an iPad to use around the house and do stuff. And what I end up doing is buying iPads for everybody else in my family. And everybody else in my family gets the basic iPad because you know what's a great machine? The cheap iPad that will just go and go and go. So that like 2018 era iPad I bought, I paid $200 for that in 2019.
That's crazy.
It was already used. I have never spent more than $400 on an iPad because I'm like, you're a tablet. You should do basic tablet stuff. I'm not going to put a keyboard on you and do other stuff. How do you feel about the iPad Air as like a laptop replacement now, especially after seeing what the Neo can do in Dan's article, Nate?
Yeah, that's a good question because I don't know. I kind of just like them myself. I like using an iPad as a laptop. So this year I reviewed the 11-inch model. The past few years, Apple's been providing us with the 13-inch Air, which I'd say is a much more viable laptop replacement, certainly.
But also just too big as a tablet. Like, I think
13, a little, yeah. The 13-inch Air is a little too big to handhold comfortably. Mm-hmm. The 13-inch Pro is light enough that it doesn't, like, feel the burden, but you're still, like, it's ridiculous to use the on-screen keyboard on, for example, that sort of thing. So, yeah, it is a little bit of an odd duck. The problem that I found with the smaller, I think the iPad, the 11-inch size, regardless of whether it's the Pro, the Air, or the basic one, is kind of like your ideal tablet size. But then when you put it in a keyboard and start to do stuff, if you go into the much improved multitasking windowing system, like it just feels a little too small to have more than like a couple apps up on the screen at a time. So yeah, I think it's like the 11-inch is good for like very focused tasks. The 13 you can kind of use more as like in the vein of a traditional laptop, I would say.
Yeah.
So it kind of depends on like where you land. Mm-hmm. But for me, I like using an iPad. It's kind of my like after work computer. Like when I'm just hanging out, watching TV, or if I want to like just go hard on, you know, writing or something, I'll use it for that.
So yeah, it's like a good little writing buddy. But you know what's a great writing buddy? The MacBook Neo, which is sitting right there and $600. Like if you wanted to have a good writing experience on the iPad Air, you're spending, what is it, $550 that it starts at now?
The Air is $600, same as the Neo.
So $600 plus at least $100 for a good keyboard. So you're getting up and up and up there. And the overall experience, too, like you're running iPad apps, you're not running macOS apps, which I feel more productive in a desktop environment, just knowing I can like hop to things pretty quickly. So it's interesting that Apple has both solutions there. The future of Macs is really what we know. Like we've heard the rumors that Apple's going to have a dynamic touch interface for their upcoming MacBook Pros. Those are going to also be OLED. We still don't have any OLED MacBooks yet, so that's like a big deal that they haven't quite hit. But I don't know. Apple's in a strange place right now. I feel like the MacBook Neo will fit the need for a lot of people. I'm looking at the Air. I still have not bought one for myself. I haven't even bought myself a basic iPad because I'm like, I paid the money for the big iPhone 17 Pro Max. That's a pretty big screen. I watch videos on that. Like when I'm in bed and I don't feel like moving after dealing with the kids, I'm watching TV shows on this phone screen because it's fine. I can hold it up to my face without my glasses. And like
it's a great screen. Perfect.
It's a great screen, especially when you hold it closely. up to your face. So yeah, we're just like in a big transition period.
I'm not big phone guys, but I totally hear where you're coming from. If you happen to be that person, then yeah, like an iPad is increasingly less useful, especially if you want to just do like tablet-y things on it.
Oh man.
But yeah, the other Air that I reviewed was the MacBook Air M5. That hasn't been published yet, but maybe by the time this goes up, it will be. But yeah, that again, kind of the same deal. It's just a chip upgrade from last year's model. And it is much more, you know, the gains when you look at benchmarks are like, you know, modest to solid improvements. GPU was the biggest one. But if you compare it to the M3 from 2 years ago, it is significantly faster across the board. The price is more, it's $100 more than last year's model, unfortunately, $1099. However, quote, in this economy, I can't really be too upset about that. Also, they doubled the storage, the base storage to 512, I believe.
There you go. So that's
like
good.
At least your money went towards something there. Mm-hmm. It's just a great Mac it's kind of reminding me, like, honestly, like this is the computer that if I had to buy one, I would buy. It does everything I need. I like the nicer screen on a MacBook Pro. But I feel less bummed about it on the MacBook Air than I do on the iPad because you're not physically interacting with it. Can't recommend it enough. It's a good computer.
It's a great, it's still a great computer. I feel like I'm also reviewing the M5 Max, MacBook Pro 16-inch. I'm like, it's still a very good computer. Apple has kind of perfected this hardware. It's just, what are we waiting for? We're waiting for OLED. We're waiting to see how you implement touchscreen in macOS. MacBook Air is still a wonderful machine and something like we're thinking about right now. Like I do, it's 2.7 pounds. It weighs the exact same as MacBook Neo. I'm kind of...
Yeah, that's surprising to me.
It's surprising, but the more I use the Neo, and the Neo is slightly smaller, it's just a little more dense. Then I have next to me like the freaking 2-pound ZenBook A14 from last year. Incredibly light machine, really nicely built. Garbage performance, just like barely usable. And that was my initial review. Like that was a Qualcomm chip, that was Windows from last year.
Oh,
okay. And it was like $1,400. So
$1,400 for this versus $600 for the Neo. And you're like, the Neo's better.
The Neo is like literally better in every way. It is half the price and like so much better performance. So you know, we have seen
without even touching the Air, which is still cheaper than that. And I imagine with an M5 just blows it out of the water.
It's like I don't want to sound like Apple fanboy over here, but it's like I like good hardware and I like when good hardware is implemented well. There was somebody responding to me on Blue Sky. I was like, oh man, Macs are just Apple has a monopoly over Macs and it's just a closed ecosystem and I don't believe in that. I'm like, well, it's not a monopoly. It's their platform and they own it and it doesn't have like undue market influence. It is not like a market dominating thing. You could argue Apple has maybe a monopoly in the smartphone world, especially when it comes to like the App Store and everything. But please learn what a monopoly is. macOS is a closed ecosystem. You don't have to, like, if you don't like it, it's not for everybody. Don't buy it if you don't believe
also,
in it.
Also, it isn't really a closed ecosystem. You can install whatever you want on it.
Well, so, you install whatever you want.
But, like,
yes.
You
can't put macOS on other hardware.
What's that?
When people say closed ecosystem, they mean like you can't just take this platform and like install some kind of like weird jailbreaked thing on it.
Well,
like,
you can
install Linux if you want. If you're a
crazy install
person.
Linux, but you can't take macOS and put it on other hardware, and that's what I think.
Right?
You're
yeah, yeah.
About. And it's like okay, yes, fair point, but Windows is the thing that is also not open, but it's flexible. It is open in terms of like the hardware it's supporting, but it's still also a lockdown system. So if you want to champion openness, please show me your Linux laptop and how.
Also, it's been this way for 40 years, so I just don't see any reason to worry about it at this point.
It's sort of like the issues come up when a company has undue influence and is like dominating a market and using its power unwisely. And we can have that argument around the smartphone world, around what Apple does in the App Store, how much money they take from developers. Those are all good arguments, but for the love of God, learn what a monopoly is.
We should finish this segment, but I do want to ask one quick question, which is why does Apple send out the MacBook Pro like M5 Max when that's probably not a laptop that most people are going to get? They're probably going to get the M5 Pro.
I mean, it depends. It depends on what you're reviewing. Sometimes they send us two things. Sometimes I've requested multiple things.
I think sometimes you'll get the Pro and the Max, right?
Yes.
So you can kind of be like, here's the crazy high end for the people who need it.
Typically, we get like the 14-inch Pro and the 16-inch Max, and they just want to show us like the range of performance. And I will be honest, this is a boring review to write because we know this is a good ass piece of hardware. They've honed this particular design of the MacBook Pro down. It's just slightly faster than last year, so I wasn't like too adamant to check out the Pro. If I have time and things slow down, I do kind of want to see what the 14-inch Pro kind of looks like. But the Max is like, it is insanely powerful. Like the people who buy MacBook Pros, and especially the 16-inch MacBook Pros, when you buy a Max, you're spending twice the cost because you're basically getting double the computing power. The Max is just like a big two Pros put together, right? So it is kind of fascinating to see the performance there. We do want to see like how the MacBook Pro evolves. This redesign is like the 2021 era, right? It's the M series chips when they first debuted that thing. I forget if it was even 2020. Because
I think it was 2021 for the M1 Pro and M1 Max MacBook Pro.
Yeah,
they had like an intermediary period where they used all the old hardware designs with the M1. Yes.
They launched M1 with the MacBook Air M1 and like that stuff. But they solved all the problems we really had with the MacBook Pro design with this current generation. So it's hard for me to complain too much at this point.
No,
so,
their laptop lineup has been exceedingly logical and very good for a while now. And the Neo kind of just expands that, if you ask me.
The Neo is just like mind-boggling. Like how we've never seen Apple work in the world of compromise like this. So they just decided to kill cheap PC Windows manufacturers, basically. Like this is just like a body blow. Because
I mean, I think that it also again speaks to the economic realities of the world right now, which is that like they've always ignored the low end. It hasn't, I mean, like Macs are expensive, but it's because they don't ever deal in the kind of lower end of the market, right?
Even the iPhone E, like the E iPhones were like, that should be cheaper. And they're always like a little $100 more than they should be. Yeah.
Yep. Yep. But this is interesting. I saw somebody, and I might have said this last week, so forgive me, but where they're like, well, you could buy basically every product, every hardware product in their ecosystem if you get the like 17E, the Neo, etc. And you can do that and spend about $2,000 to get like all like five of their main hardware platforms, which is a little wild.
It's pretty wild. Pretty wild. Yeah. And pretty, I don't know, this is how you kind of win hearts and minds and how you move people over to your platform too. I think Microsoft and I think PC makers should be worried because a lot of people are fed up with like the not so great performance from cheap Windows machines. A lot of people are fed up with Microsoft with putting Copilot garbage everywhere too and prioritizing that over making Windows better. So I've been ringing this bell because I'm like, hey, there's a great platform here if you just get over the hump of shifting from Windows to Mac. It's not that hard. And in the long run, this is where the better hardware is. So that's kind of where I sit with that. Keep an eye out for my final review of the 16-inch M5 Max MacBook Pro. It's coming soon. And your MacBook Air M5 review is coming soon too, Nate, right?
That is correct.
All right. Stay tuned to Engadget for all that stuff. And yeah, I'm sure we'll have some commentary on all this new Apple hardware too. All right, let's move on to some other news. Nate is still around for this one. Starting off with the story I saw from the Washington Post, a whistleblower claims ex-Doge member says he took Social Security data to a new job. That is secure, like Social Security data of 500 million Americans?
Yes. That's a lot.
Yeah.
But it is the Social Security data of almost every living American.
That's wild.
And so, a bunch of dead ones.
Yeah. The latest information on the story, Social Security Watchdog is investigating claims that the Doge employee copied that database.
Let me just tell you, I have all the confidence in the world that this watchdog is going to do something about this.
Yeah, unfortunately.
This is
sarcasm, everyone. I
mean, yeah. This is 100%. The alarm bell that was being sounded a year and change ago when this was all happening.
Because like, you can't have these tech bros with very little security clearance out here messing up with databases who knows what they can do with this data? And so many companies would love to have a lot of access to this, including the ones that are trying to track us all. So that's fun.
Yes.
I mean, this is exactly what everyone who was fired from that government agency 18F was talking about. Like, we put so much of our effort into making sure that we did everything legally, and the Doge guys are just like, okay, well, if nobody is going to like point a gun at us for doing this, we are going to do whatever we want.
It was honestly
there was so much chaos that they could just dive in and do whatever they wanted. And I imagine this is not the only person who has this database.
Yeah. The more I think about this, the more like I will never forgive Elon Musk and his like cronies for what they have done here, because it's not been fully revealed the extent of this damage. But from USAID alone, the amount of damage and harm that is being brought upon the world just because these tech bros claimed they were fighting for efficiency, but were using AI to just strip they asked AI about DEI, and then they killed programs and fired people. It's disgusting. It's going to take us decades to rebuild this sort of infrastructure in America. Good job, bros. The richest man in the world crippled us in so many respects. It's just awful. Anything else you guys want to say about this story?
I want to talk about other bad news from gaming, which is that Valve is like, oh yeah, that Steam machine that we talked about.
No, so I do want to update because I saw your initial story there, Ben. So they do plan to ship a Steam machine this year, but there was a blog post last week that felt a little wishy-washy. It felt a little like, oh, I don't know if this is happening, guys. So they clarified
from
the
Verge. Right?
Yeah. So that was just bad language, I think. And I think, yes, this thing was supposed to be shipped in spring. We were expecting to see it now. A delay to like the fall and holiday season kind of makes sense given the way hardware works right now. A delay until 2027 would be deadly. It would just like kill
major bummer,
and the enthusiasm Valve has right now for the Steam machine would kind of just evaporate. So I am sure that they're like pushing this. It's really about availability of hardware. It's about RAM. It's about all that stuff all put together. I believe
we still don't have a reliable price estimate, do we?
No.
That's wow. Gonna be the last thing. Nothing. There's pricing of anything right now.
Okay, so that could be a real kick in the teeth too. Like,
yes,
we're doing everything else for Techtober, and then all of a sudden it's like, surprise, the Steam machine exists and it's $1,300. It would have been cheaper, but given the way everything is right now.
Yeah, speaking of never forgiving, I'll never forgive these stupid AI companies for doing all this garbage that's making hardware so expensive. And like, we don't want that crap. I want to be able to buy a Steam machine or get some RAM for my computer or an external hard drive or whatever.
These guys wanted to say first, they want to say first commenter in the world of AI. I'm now the leader in the world of AI. Hey, we can blame Elon Musk for that too, because he's a big part of it.
Yeah, because he's just a horrible human.
And he bought up, he's still trying to make XAI a thing. He did buy up a ton of hardware too. So, hey, great.
The issue is that you can also have AI development pace without like disrupting the global supply chain for important components.
Can we, Ben?
Can we?
I mean, yeah, but the only issue is that they're like, they being like the US AI industry is like, well, if we don't go at absolutely breakneck pace in a way that changes the entire market for the globe, then somebody else is going to develop the AI first, and then it's going to be bad. That feels like threatening an 8-year-old with like magical logic on a global scale.
Why was TikTok forced to sell itself in America? Vague threats about China, nothing actually real. But hey, now big U.S. companies get to base it literally gobble up TikTok and make money off of that, too. So
while we're talking about AI, I want to, like, this is a little bit out of order for our show notes, but let's just run through the idea that, like, the next tick in the story has happened. Anthropic has sued the U.S. government over it being designated a supply chain risk. There's really no other information here. It's just, like, there's probably going to be some legal discovery, which is interesting for media types like us, because we're going to be able to see some private emails that weren't previously made public.
It is funny because we talked about this last week and we had a great chat with Spencer Ackerman. Go listen to that episode, like his intro alone. There's a reason I clipped it for social media because Spencer is just great. We had to let him cook for a while. But this whole thing is literally a temper tantrum by Pete Hegseth. So
I feel very weird being based on everything I was just saying. I feel pretty weird being on the side of the AI company in this case, but I will support almost anyone over Pete Hegseth.
Good God. And I mean, Spencer made the good point that technically companies should not be dictating like how governments deploy and use their technology, but also don't sell your shit to the government for warfare efforts if you don't expect it to be used in the worst way possible. Like, you are giving up any moral claim you have on anything there. That's the main thing. Also, talk about AI being bad. Grammarly, stealing journalists' names to act as editing experts. That's a fun thing.
Yeah, so like, how does this actually work, especially if you're just on the like audio version of the show? Imagine something like the comments that you would see on Google Docs, except it's not your coworker or something. The person in the margins has the name of some relatively well-known journalist.
I think it's not just journalists, too.
And I mean, if you don't work in media, then maybe you don't recognize any of these names at all.
It's not just journalists, though. That's like what got all the attention, because The Verge did a story about how like a bunch of their editors' names was being used. But also, I looked back at what Grammarly said the intent was, and it was like not just, it was like authors, like including some who are no longer alive. It was like all sorts of writers.
Okay, well, so what is it going to do? It's going to be like Cormac McCarthy says, stop putting punctuation in. You don't need those quotation marks.
Too many capitalized words.
No, that's a style specific to you, my guy.
That's it's sometimes you just want to take like a rolled up newspaper and go to these AI companies and be like, no, stop it. Why did you do this? We don't train animals like that anymore. But we should train AI companies like this. Stop
and to
it.
Be clear that none of these people who were cited gave their permission for this.
I do feel offended because they basically pulled all of The Verge, all of The Verge's people here. Nobody from Engadget. Come on. You can pretend to be us. We could be there.
Yeah, it's also funny that we're looking at a Neiman Lab story and like that's a journalism kind of like nonprofit operating out of like Harvard or something. It is Harvard.
It is Harvard.
And one of the people who's, you know, in this Grammarly thing is the editor-in-chief of Neiman Lab. It's just like we scraped a bunch of names of various people. So my idea about why this uniquely sucks is something that I've thought about for a really long time, which is like, reporters, they're pretty visible, but they're also not really like famous, and they don't get access to a lot of the good parts of being like a notable person. So it's like you're very visible, but you don't often have like a army of lawyers enforcing your image or name rights, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that can be a real problem.
But at the basic level, how did you ever think this was okay, Grammarly? Like literally, the basic thing people are asking for in the world of media, especially with programs like this, is permission. All these AI tools have been built by scraping up copyrighted works. Authors are fighting. Media companies are fighting them. Like, you just think this is okay to do? I don't even understand how you do this in 2026. It's just wild to me. So apparently, after all this fighting, Grammarly is disabling the tool. And a class action lawsuit is being started, is being formed right now from what I can tell.
Because class actions are also something that's much more accessible to the average journalist. You can't just like wage your own lawsuit for your specific name, because most of these people don't have like hundreds of thousands of dollars to burn on lawsuits like that.
We can all attest to that.
Absolutely. You wanted to talk about the story, Ben, about apparently most chatbots will help users plan a violent attack. That is
the other news section today. It's just horrible AI news, apparently. And I think it's like that most weeks, but it feels even more pronounced today.
So I mean, connect this with the idea from a few weeks ago where I think it was Popular Science talked about a study done in the UK about how so many chatbots are like, actually, in a global conflict, let's just use a nuke.
Let's just use a nuke.
Even if we're told not to, We might just use a nuke.
We've learned nothing from war games. Let's just use the nukes. And
the only winning move is not to play. Why weren't the chatbots instructed that? But in this recent study, researchers posed as a 13-year-old boy, aka the average 4chan user, or at least, you know, 10 years ago, the average 4chan user. And they asked ChatGPT and Gemini and Claude and Copilot and Meta AI and DeepSeek and Perplexity and Snapchat My AI, I guess, and Character.ai, also Replica, across 18 different scenarios just a few months ago, between November and December of 2025. The tests simulated users planning school shootings, political assassinations, and bombings targeting synagogues specifically. And in 3 out of 4 cases, 75% of the time across all of these platforms, they were not discouraged.
They got actionable assistance.
They discouraged violence just 12% of the time, although Claude, Anthropic's model, did discourage violence eventually about 76% of the time.
Maybe we should be asking more questions about these tools, because we also keep seeing stories about the AI psychosis that's happening, where it's just like, for some people, talking with the chatbot will lead you to do crazy things. We talked about the guy who basically had planned a terrorist attack to save his AI girlfriend and get her.
Oh, yeah, that was just last week when we were talking.
That was just last week. Maybe we should do something about these models, because it's just these things are out there and people are using them freely and we have thought so little about it. So I'm going to get the complaint that, hey, we are being very, very AI negative. Stop being garbage, AI industry. Then we will stop reporting on bad AI news. I think that's the
Let's also talk about near-term versus near-term harm versus long-term benefit. Like AlphaFold basically solved protein folding. That's fantastic. That's amazing. Google and DeepMind won a Nobel Prize for that.
That's more machine learning than anything, but yeah. Yeah,
that's going to be something that has some long-term benefit. Maybe we can figure out some like prion diseases or things that cause brain plaques like Alzheimer's disease. That is a long-term thing, though. In the near term, we have people planning school shootings that they are going to probably act out in the next 6 to 8 months. And you have supercharged that ability. So how many people are going to do those things in the near term versus how many people can be saved in the long term? This starts to sound like kind of a rationalist like thought experiment. I wonder why, like, the AI industry is full of these folks. DeepSeek even signed off on its rifle selection advice with happy and safe shooting. Good God, guys.
We live in hell. As I told Spencer last week, the appropriate response to all this stuff is seems bad. Seems really bad going down this time.
Sick, sad world.
Sick, sad world. All right, Nate, thank you so much for joining us to talk about Apple and this hellscape that we're living through. Where can people find you these days?
Yeah, I am occasionally on Blue Sky and Threads at Nate Ingram.
Awesome. Thank you so much. And keep an eye out for Nate's reviews at Engadget.com.
Thank you.
Next up on this episode, we really want to talk about what's going on in the state of the EV market, because gas prices are real bad right now. I wonder why. I wonder for whatever reason, oil prices have gone up, gas prices have shot up. Things are pretty bad right now for many, many reasons. But joining us to talk about that is sustainability editor at SAE International, Roberto Baldwin. Hello, Robbie. How's it going?
Hello. How's it going? If you're picking up gas today, I apologize. That's AAA yesterday said that gas prices had gone up on average 60 cents a gallon.
I saw that.
That was yesterday. Who knows?
That was yesterday.
I know. Right now, as of recording, crude oil futures are at $94.86. I just mentioned it in between segments when we were recording, and it's gone up $1 since then.
So, yeah.
I saw the AAA number yesterday. It was $3.48 a gallon average. from just under $3 a week ago. So it's like 50 cents jump over a week. Things are pretty bad because America and Israel started an unprovoked war in Iran, and the Strait of Hormuz is shut down because everybody saw this coming. This is why you don't do this. You idiots.
I was concerned when the administration admitted that they didn't see it coming. I'm like, I mean, that's on, that's their MO. That's on par for, you know, that's what I would expect. It's like, we punched a bear, didn't realize it would make the bear angry. Like, well,
man. It's real bad.
We left all the water on in our house and didn't realize it would flood the house. I'm like, oh, guys, come on.
It's Biden's fault, though. So I really just want to talk with you about like where we are right now, Robbie, because I feel like I'm always keeping an eye on Carvana. I have an ICE car right now, an ICE internal combustion engine, not a car stolen from ICE, although that would be fun too. But I have a Volvo XC90, which I love a lot, but it is a gas guzzler. And I'm always like, what is the next step? Is the next step going to be the hybrid because I want the Sienna for like a big family vehicle, or straight to a big ass EV like the Kia EV9. I was checking Carvana over the last week. Kia EV9's all gone. Every time one pops up, bought immediately. God.
Yeah, well,
so yeah. And that seems to be happening for many, many things. And I think a lot of people, especially maybe people in California, where I am so sorry, Robbie, your gas prices are insane.
We have insane gas prices, but we also have roads that you can drive on. I've been to Michigan.
Well, you've been to roads that exist in winter. Yeah, bad.
Yeah. So the gas. You know what's funny is I haven't actually looked at the gas when I'm driving around doing things. I keep forgetting to look at the gas prices.
You're fill it up. Yeah.
Yeah, because I don't. You know, I have two cars. I have a Hyundai Ioniq 5, and I have a Subaru BRZ. So the BRZ isn't really a gas guzzler. It's a little sports car. Love that car, manual transmission, but mostly we drive the Ioniq 5. And so now we're just going to drive the Ioniq 5 more.
Just drive it more.
We're just going to drive. If we're going somewhere, we're going to take that vehicle. It's you know, it's unfortunate for, you know, people who can't afford to get a new car. That's you know, and that's that's been the issue with EVs for the last, you know, 10 years or something, is that relatively speaking, they're more expensive. Vehicles in general are more expensive. The average price is around $50,000+, which is insane. But what's great is that because EVs have been out for a while now, we're no longer talking about vehicles that are, you know, compliance vehicles, you know, cars that get like 100, you know, 80 miles per of range. Those vehicles have now fallen into the used car market. And that's where you really, you know, get a pretty great deal, to be honest, on an EV.
Amazing deals.
And when you're looking at the first two generations of the Leaf, those batteries didn't really hold up very well. And that was a design decision. And also the Leaf was sort of the first mass produced EV. So they were trying out a lot of different things. Now, any, you know, used EV from the last few years, the battery's not going to be, it's going to be fine. Outside of any sort of issues with batteries, that would be the same issue you would, you know, a used car is typically fine outside of any issues with the engine or the transmission or the, you know, the coolant system or, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You're still going into, you know, it is a used vehicle. Most of them will still have a warranty. So you have that going for you. And when you look at gas price, I mean, it was already cheaper to drive my EV. Before we got the Ioniq 5, we had a Kona Electric. I did the how much would it cost to drive 100 miles in each vehicle? And this is when I figured gas was $5 a gallon, and I was charging at home with my vehicle. To drive 100 miles in the BRZ was $18. To drive 100 miles in my Kona Electric was $6. So, yeah. Now we have a far more efficient vehicle. Yeah. I still have the same BRZ because I love that car. But I think, you know, when I think about, you know, just vehicles in general, the average person, an EV is more than adequate for what you're doing during the day. You know, enthusiasts are always going to want to have some sort of gas car, but you don't typically drive that car all the time. You know, case in point, me and my BRZ, love the BRZ, don't drive it as much as I do the Ioniq 5. And what's interesting is that, you know, after the the credits went away, the financial incentives from the government, you know, there was a drop in EV sales. But previous to that, there was a huge surge in EV sales because everyone was trying to get that EV that they wanted ahead of losing any sort of incentive, financial incentive they could get from the federal government. And they were, like a month later, everyone was writing articles, oh, EV sales are have cratered. I'm like, okay, you're not...
Let's look at the context. Yeah, look at what just happened.
Those articles, yeah. I mean, to be fair, and some of my friends wrote those articles, and I'm sorry, but those were disingenuous articles.
It's over. Let's give up on the whole EV thing. It's failed,
look at
right?
You know, you have to take the metrics. You know, look at the metrics.
And they were talking about sales of new EVs, right?
They were talking about sales of new EVs. They're like, oh, they've cratered. I'm like, you're going to have to wait until like March of next year. I said this on the Wheel Bearings podcast that I'm on. You know, you have to wait until like March. And guess what? Guess what's doing super well right now? Previous to the unprovoked war, EV sales have come back. I think everyone likes to use the IONIQ 5 as a sort of bellwether. Year-over-year sales, I think, have increased to 6% for that vehicle. Unfortunately for the IONIQ 6, it's not built, you know, Hyundai is taking that out of, you know, out of the U.S. market outside of the GT version. To be honest, it just never really resonated with people.
It was redundant.
People didn't like the way it looked, period. It's also not built in the USA like the IONIQ 5. There's a lot of things working again. I think it only sold like 12, 13,000, 16.
People don't like sedans anymore. Like,
I think it was less sedans and more the design of that vehicle, to be honest. It drives better than the IONIQ 5.
Interesting.
Yeah, they did some really, really interesting and really nice acceleration mapping on that vehicle that they really didn't have to do. Like right after the IONIQ 5 came out, we did the IONIQ 6 drive. And driving that vehicle, like, they didn't have to make it this much better. They just did. They could have just left it.
They just did. That's like Kia and Hyundai right now in general with all their EVs. You didn't have to go this hard, but you kind of did, and I appreciate you for it. Like the EV9 is in many ways feels like a better car than the Rivian, which is often twice as much as that car, but it has features I appreciated more than the Rivian R1S.
Yeah. Well, it has physical controls, which I think when it comes down to it, I think physical controls are extremely important. I think a lot of automakers got kind of sucked into like, well, Tesla sold X billions of vehicles and they don't really have physical controls. Well, Tesla was and still is sort of the Kleenex of EVs. They were really the only people in town who were selling something that delivered on the sort of EV promise. Now that other vehicles are on the market, obviously Tesla's losing market share. It's still got a lot of share. They should have expected this. I think, you know, Elon's sort of foray into supervillain and government employee hasn't helped them to be. But even if he hadn't done any of that, what if he decided just to be a normal human? They still would have lost market share. That's just the nature of what was going to happen to them.
There's more competition. Yeah. So the last time we talked, Robbie, like it was when I wrote the article, like now's the perfect time to buy a used EV. That was in August of last year as the credits were ending. But also I was looking at that used EV market and things were looking pretty. And it does seem like things are still pretty good out there. Like I bought a 2018 Leaf. So that's like second gen Leaf, not the kind of ugly-ish first design. And it was like about 15,000 now. That car, under 10,000 now. The 2022 models are around 15,000 now. IONIQ 5 hovering around 20,000 or less, depending on how old it is. Polestar 2. Insane for what that car is. The Polestar 2, by the way, a $70,000 plus car. Between 20,000 and 25,000.
I think there is a misunderstanding of what battery technology, how well batteries last. Mercedes did a whole thing where they realized, oh, batteries last longer than we anticipated. You know, in their own tests. So, you know,
always good to get that news.
Yeah, it's always good to get that. Like, they don't degrade nearly as quickly as we had anticipated, which is great. I think a lot of these companies were being a little like, well, see, especially the Germans. The Germans are very careful people.
Except when they're not.
Except when they're not.
Except when they on purpose mislead you about the emissions.
Yeah.
Well, that company is not doing so great still.
That was a well-executed fraud. That was a really well-executed fraud that lasted decades, right? That was a really
efficient fraud
over there. Yeah. They really did that all for
And that company's still having issues with, you know, since then, I think, you know, even if the
let's name names, either, it was Volkswagen, wasn't it?
No, it's Volkswagen. Sorry. I just assume everyone knew Volkswagen did a bad thing.
But a lot of pretty much every other many European car makers.
Yeah. Mercedes was also. Yeah. Mercedes, BMW, I think
they were all lying about diesel.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a huge scam. Post that, you know, I know Volkswagen Group has been very, you know, when you look at the Volkswagen Group's EVs, they underreport their numbers for EPA range numbers just because they're still paranoid. So the fallout from that continues to reverberate within that company, within all the brands.
I am seeing, hey, the Buzz did not sell well, but I am seeing Buzzes all over the place now, and the price of those things on the used market dipping below 50,000, which is
that was a misstep, really. I mean, they 7 years to bring that thing to market. When they did bring it to market, yeah, they didn't have an entry level vehicle, they had a mid level, and then they had, and it was expensive. It was built by the commercial division. I think Volkswagen did almost anything it could to shoot itself in the foot bringing that car to market, which is unfortunate because when I had it, I really liked the ID Buzz. I know that it does only get, you know, in my test, it gets about 240, 245 range versus the, you know, the 220 or 230 they're saying. It's a great dog car. There's no rear cup holders. There's all these weird things. There's no dog mode. You can't leave the car on. Unless you're in the seat,
yeah.
So let's say I take it camping. I'm in the back of the car. I want the air conditioning on, or I want the heater on. You can't just leave the car on. You have to click the seatbelt in order for the car to stay on. There's just all these like weird little like what were
That's
you,
wild.
You had the opportunity, like someone softballed them the ability to do a home run and they hit a double, and they're just like, what?
It sits like a van. Like, it sits very much like a van, too. Like, I feel like the driving height is maybe a little too high. You have to climb up into that sucker, you know, compared to
Siennas
a lot of, like,
and yeah,
like
yeah,
a minivan.
It sits more like a van.
Or Sienna or whatever. But yeah. Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Overall, what should someone who's EV curious now?
And it's a good time to be EV curious.
They're driving past their local gas stations and they're like, ooh, that doesn't look good. Beyond just the idea of you want some buttons and knobs rather than just an iPad and the dashboard, what are we talking about in terms of battery health numbers, about like good brands and other like kind of unknown unknowns that you, the car guy, would be able to tell us?
I would wholeheartedly support someone buying a Kia or a Hyundai. Anything from the Hyundai Motor Group, EV9, EV6, IONIQ 5, IONIQ 9. These are 800-volt architecture vehicles. Hyundai went all in on their architecture for 800 volts, which means that these vehicles are more efficient than 400 volt. They charge quicker. I think my IONIQ 5 charges like 230. The new ones charge at like 240, 250. Mm-hmm. And so these vehicles, you know, they're great. I've road tripped my IONIQ 5 dozens of times at this point. And you can actually get them for pretty, you know, pretty inexpensive, relatively speaking, you know, mid-20s and below. I know that the F-150 Lightning just never... this is a Ford issue, to be honest. This is a management issue where they kept changing the prices. They didn't really understand the market. They just thought, well, you know, the F-150, the F-Series is a huge seller. The problem is the F-Series people are people who are like, vroom, vroom, trucks. That's what they want. F-150 Lightning... it's probably a pretty good deal at this point. So there are some really good EVs out there. A Bolt, you know, if you just want like a nice bare bones like EV, it's not great for long distances. It only charges at 50 kilowatts. But if you need sort of an around town second car, or if you just don't do road trips, the American road trip was essentially murdered by cheap airline fares. To be honest, a lot of people don't do very many road trips.
It's such an old concept at this point, but yeah.
Even though there are no federal incentives, look at state and local incentives. Within California has incentives, and within California, if you live in the San Joaquin Valley, there's some crazy incentive. I'm like, maybe I should just move to the San Joaquin Valley so I can buy EVs. I know Colorado has a lot of incentives. So you know, look at the incentives that are available within your state, within your local region. You could usually get a pretty good deal both on even your utility company. Well, sometimes you're like, hey, you know, we'll give you this if you buy an EV. If you have a home, if you have somewhere where you can charge it at home, do it. Pay the, you know, have the electrician come out, put in a charger, put in the NEMA, I believe the 1450 in, and you can just buy a charger you can plug in, mount it to a fence, mount it to a wall.
Do it. Even, I will tell you, even level one, if it's your secondary car, you're driving less than 30 miles a day, like level plug it into
just the AC regular old
jack, like
wall,
plug it in. But be careful. I need to write about this because I had a charger that was a little too aggressive. It was a 16 amp level one charger. I was plugging it into one of the outlets in front of my house. It was a 15 amp.
Oh, so you want to be 20% above what the, yeah. So if you're getting like say a 50 amp, charger, you want a 60 amp.
I said 1.5.
Yeah.
1.5.
So for 15, you'd probably want a 20 amp, you know, outlet. So
that outlet caught on fire. I had to get the fire department over here because it's just drawing too much power. I was like, oh, this is bad.
Do not use extension cords. It's just like your home heater. Don't use extension cords when you're using a heater at home that you plug into the wall. Just plug it directly into the wall. Make sure that you have the correct, you know, power. If you have questions, you know, if you're gonna have an electrician come out, if you have a smart friend who just happens to know about electricity, I went to someone's house and they were running power from their house over the street into their car, and I was like, ooh, oh no.
Yeah.
And I was about to talk to them, like, yeah, I'm an electrical engineer. I'm like, oh, never mind then. like they had the correct, you know, you can get an extension. Like, I have an extension for my my level two, but I have the correct, you know, I have a 60 amp or maybe 70. Anyway, I have more than enough, you know, extra amps. So it's.
So Robbie, you are the standards guy.
Yeah.
You work for SAE, the standards company. Is there a standard for battery health when it comes to EVs? Because I think a lot of people who are, you know, Engadget readers and listeners always care about the battery health of anything else used that they buy. How are you supposed to figure that out for a car?
There is a company that has an app that.
Okay, so what you're saying is that there's no actual wide standard yet.
Well, most EVs have the little battery meter, right? If you go into the settings, you can see battery level life or something like that, Robbie. The Leaf has that, yeah.
It depends. The thing is that, you know, there are some things that just aren't on most EVs. You know, while there are standards for charging, there are standards for how you cool the battery. You know, there's a lot of different standards for a lot of different things. The way standards works is that it's not just SAE doesn't just come out and say, hey, this is the standard, everyone follow it. It doesn't work that way. SAE is really a facilitator of getting the entire industry together. And then they all sit in a room, not really, but they all get together, you know, automakers, suppliers, researchers, all these people get together to figure out a proper standard, to see what works best for everyone and and hopefully for the consumer. You know, J3400, the NACS standard, I mean, that belonged to Tesla. Tesla gave that up. And it belongs to the industry now. It is an SAE standard, you know, and that's the Tesla port, the Tesla plug that everyone's slowly moving over to. And so there is a company, or there's probably a few at this point, that will check the battery health. And then some used car makes, you know, Carvana type places will tell you, like, you know, you can ask, like, what is the battery? What is the degradation of this battery? And that is the biggest concern, I think, for most people when they're talking about used cars. For the most part, most of the degradation is like 5%, maybe. It's not nearly as bad as it used to be. It's not, yeah.
Really?
The first Leafs, Nissan Leafs, the degradation was absolutely horrible. because they were air cooled. These batteries now are, you know, most batteries are now liquid cooled. You know, it's different. The chemistries have been updated and they're constantly changing. They're constantly tweaking these systems. The battery management system, the BMS, the software that runs the battery is always working to move things around. There is sort of a split within the industry, whereas people like Tesla will give you the entire pack. So if it says 100 kilowatt hours, that battery is exactly 100 kilowatt hours. Whereas, say, Audi might say, oh, it's 90, you know, you get 94 kilowatt hours, but the actual pack is 100 kilowatt hours. So there's usable versus gross. And what happens is that the system sees, oh, here are some cells that are sort of dying. Let's take those out of the loop and start using these additional cells. So you will continue to have that 90 kilowatt or 92 kilowatt hours that you've been told that you have, even the battery's larger. So it's, you know, you're subbing in players. You got people on the bench who are coming in to run your vehicle. So, you know, that's one of the things you kind of want to look at. You're like, well, does this company use, is it usable versus gross, or is it everything? Outside of Tesla, I can't remember who else does everything, but most automakers have a usable versus gross, which means is that those battery packs, even though there's some degradation, they have backups that sort of sub in order to keep your battery. So you still get the range that you were promised. If you are a person who always drives, you know, the vehicle is going to determine like what your range is based on your behavior. So for example, I drive cars for a living. My wife loves sport mode. So while our car will do like 303 miles of range, if we charge it to 100%, it says like 280. That's because of our behavior, because we don't, because we drive.
I've been in a car with you, Robbie. It is a fun experience, but you got to like hold on. You got to make sure those all the handrails work.
Was that the Cadillac in Las Vegas?
It was the Cadillac, I think. Or no, it was an Audi, maybe.
Okay, so that wasn't really my fault. They gave me a Blackwing with, I believe it was manual transmission with summers when it was like 30 degrees and raining. So, and the Las Vegas streets are notoriously slick anyway.
No, it wasn't that. It was an Audi. I think you had the big Audi, one of the e-trons at one point.
Oh, okay. Fun, yeah.
But also, you know.
Okay, fine. All
right. Wait. Okay, yeah, that was my fault, actually.
No, that was my fault. If you're ever in the car with me and you feel like you're like, hey, could you slow down? I would happily slow down. I'm never going to be like, what's wrong with you? No, I believe I don't want people to feel uncomfortable when I'm driving. I do. But if it makes you feel better, I drive a lot.
You can feel it. You understand the road. I am a cautious driver. I'm a defensive driver because there are things I'm always worried about. But I want to drive like you.
Well, Robbie, you should never trust anyone.
Yeah, exactly. Don't trust anybody. I want to point out most used car listings, especially EVs, have like usually a shot of their like battery level. So if you're buying a Nissan Leaf or something, they'll say like, oh, you have 10 bars. That's a full battery. If it's 9 bars, that means degradation or something has started. So keep an eye out for that if you're looking at listings. We're mainly talking about used and maybe new EVs. Lease options are great. A lot of manufacturers are throwing credits or they're throwing discounts into leases because the credits have gone away and they're trying to get these cars off the lot. Last year in Colorado, you were able to lease a freaking, the Alfa Romeo? The like little, the Fiat, the 500E for like $100 a month. $100 a month for a cute little Fiat. It's not huge, but that's a great like around town car for sure with not much range. So those are all great options. It is a good time to look at EVs, and yeah, just good luck out there if you're surviving what gas prices are going to be, because it's the outlook is not great, right, Robbie? Like it's gonna be months before things ever get back to normal.
I kind of wish that we didn't have to have a war for people to be like, oh, maybe EVs, because I think maybe people should have been beforehand, maybe EVs. But one of my biggest issues with EVs has been the cost. You know, the Bolt is coming back for 18 months for some weird reason. Like, not the weird reason, the Bolt should never have gone away, to be honest. But you know, it's inexpensive.
Yeah.
You know, Nissan had to remove the sort of entry level, Nissan Leaf that was inexpensive, but relatively speaking, those vehicles are inexpensive. They drive well. They're in, you know, I've driven that car. It's a great little car. Slate,
I love the new Leaf.
Yeah. The new Leaf's great. The Slate is supposed to have vehicles on the road by the end of the year. They have 160,000 reservations. So, if you don't have a reservation, I don't know how long this is going to be before you get that. Of course, you have to think about, you know, how many people are actually going to buy those vehicles versus, how many are they going to convert to actual purchases? So we do have, you know, between used vehicles and some vehicles that are coming to market, they're actually less expensive. We don't need more $100,000 EVs. We're good. The Lucid Air is a engineering masterpiece. It is also very expensive. It is, you know.
It's so expensive. What are your thoughts on the Lucid Gravity that everybody is like?
Oh, it's so good. It's a minivan.
It's a minivan. That's exactly what I was going to ask you. That's not an SUV. That is clearly a minivan. Yeah. You just put normal doors.
It
on.
Is.
So don't pretend that that's an SUV.
It is so. Yeah. It drives so well. There's, you know, the load height is really low. It's absolutely wonderful. It's a great EV. I think, you know, what Lucid does engineering wise is unbelievable. You know, they're supposed to have, you know, less expensive EV coming out, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Moving that downstream will be really exciting. If you have a lot of money and you want an SUV that's essentially,
well, you've got options.
Like kind of like a it looks like a Volvo wagon.
I'm looking at pictures of the interior and I'm still kind of disappointed by how it's just all tablet.
Yeah, that's the thing is, like, the higher up you go, the more it's all tablet. Put some buttons in there. And Hyundai Kias, they went backwards. They started adding more buttons.
Yeah, actually, Robbie, you would know the name of the exact European auto safety regulation board that said, like, hey guys, you need more buttons, right?
Yeah, I think it was NCAP. And then China is also saying you can't have cars that don't have buttons. They have to have physical controls. Which is, yes, you should have physical controls. It should be able to use muscle memory to be able to do, and, you know, things, whether it's, you know, climate controls or the volume or a couple, you know, drive modes. All these things I should be able to, if I have to turn and look at something because a screen, while you're like, oh, I know where everything is on the screen. Guess what? Your car bounces, your finger moves around. So you have to pay more attention to the screen. I had a huge fight with Tesla with the Model 3 when it came out, where they were like, well, you know, talking about, you know, they had moved the wipers into the screen. And I was like, that's not safe. And they're like, well, you know, but it comes on automatically. I'm like, it didn't come on automatically when it started raining when I had the car until, like, you know, 2 minutes in. It wasn't safe. It's not safe. It is a safety issue. You know, the automakers do this because it saves them money. They're already going to have a screen in the car. So now they don't have to worry about, you know, hardware buttons. They don't have to worry about wiring harnesses. Like, there's a lot of financial reasons for automakers to not have these in here. Tesla can say whatever it wants about not having a dash cluster, about, oh, it's clean. No, you don't want to pay for that extra screen. That's why that dash cluster is not in the Model 3 mm-hmm, and the Model mm-hmm, Y. Mm-hmm. You don't want to pay for it. And you're going to tell us this roundabout insane reason, but the reality is it's cheaper for you to build this car.
And when we say buttons, I'm saying mechanical buttons. None of that capacitive bullshit. Like, I don't... I'm pressing on plastic and I don't have a feeling of where anything is. You're just as bad as a screen.
It doesn't move. That's the only, like, you know, it's in a fixed spot.
If there's haptics, maybe.
Yeah.
Also, hopefully there's, like, some texture and stuff, because, I mean, the texture is there for a reason. It's not for low vision people, of course. You're not going to be driving. It's so that you can know this button has this texture, this button has this texture, so you can keep your eyes on the road.
Yeah, it really comes out. That's one of the reasons I like the idea of the Slate a lot. It is just buttons. There's no tablet. None of that's in there. It's just big old knobs and buttons to do things. It doesn't have any driver's assistance, to be honest, outside of, like, what is regulated by NHTSA that you need in the vehicle, you know, rear backup camera, etc. My BRZ, that's one of the reasons why I love my BRZ. It's just big, giant knobs to do things. It has an infotainment system. It's the worst infotainment system on the planet. All it's good for is plugging in my phone and playing music. That's all it does.
Which is all we need. All we need.
Which is really all you need. You know, navigation is great in a screen. You know, any sort of like weird like settings that you have to do typically when you're parked somewhere, you know, sure, put those in the screen. But most, you know, controls, don't, for the love of Pete, stop putting vent controls in the screen. That makes absolutely zero sense. I don't care how fancy the Rivians are. I really like the Rivians a lot. I like the R1T. I like the R1S. I'm not going to buy one because I can't use the vent. And you don't realize how much you use the vent until you think about how often you use the vent.
All right, Robbie, I've taken up enough of your time. Thank you so much for joining us. Where can we find your work online these days? I've heard you on many podcasts. Where can we find you?
So we have the SAE Automotive Engineering Podcast. If you're really nerdy about cars, we talk to people in the industry who are the people who build the things for your cars, you know, software-defined vehicles, autonomous driving. So we talk to people, you know, we talk to automakers, we talk to suppliers, we talk to researchers. So that's, you know, if you're a big car nerd, that's a great place. The Wheel Bearings Podcast, we talk, it's a little bit more lighthearted. It's more like this podcast, except it's all cars all the time. And we complain a lot about vehicles without vent controls. So if you're into that... if you're into getting angry about the lack of hardware controls on vents, oh, you should listen to the Wheel Bearings Podcast. And hold on.
WX Romer in the YouTube chat said, ask Robbie how he feels about automated air vents. And at the time, I didn't even know that this was actually bait.
Don't
say anything because we don't have time.
And then articles, mobilityengineeringtech.com. That's the where we're all my articles are going. It also has aviation stuff. And so, yeah, so if you're, it's written for people, but also engineers. So if you're, so if you want to get super nerdy, if you're the kind of person who trolls the Ars Technica forums, I think this works really well for you. If you just want a light, you know, very light articles about, automotive, it's probably less. But you can, you know, it's fun to learn. Everyone learns.
Everyone learns. Thank you so much, Robbie.
Thank you, Robbie.
Chat with you next time, hopefully not.
I'm not going to yay war. I'm yaying chat next time.
Yay. All right, folks, we've been going for a while. I just want to quickly shout out an exclusive we got. Igor Bonifacic wrote about Rabbit's Cyberdeck, which is going to be their modern take on a netbook. This thing doesn't actually exist yet, but Rabbit is calling it a dedicated vibe coding machine. So go check out Igor's article about this thing. And also, hey, Cyberdeck, that's a trend. Trends are happening. Very much, we should do a whole episode about that because that is people basically trying to hack together really tiny laptops. That's what it is. So if you look on TikTok right now, people are showing off their Cyberdecks.
Yep, I saw that.
Yeah, I put a Cyberdeck in a purse. I put a Cyberdeck in a bag. And now Rabbit is going to be doing one. I do wonder, Rabbit had no clue that Apple was going to release a $600 laptop with like leading class hardware. So I don't know if they're going to be able to keep up with that, but we shall see. Check out Igor's article, Rabbit Cyberdeck is a modern take on a netbook.
That's it for the episode. Thanks everybody for listening. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our former managing editor, Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is produced by me, Ben Elman. You can find Devendra online at...
at Devendra on Blue Sky, and I podcast about movies and TV at the Filmcast at thefilmcast.com.
Send me all your listings for EV station wagons at Hey Bellman on Blue Sky. Email us at podcast@engadget.com. Leave us a review on iTunes and subscribe on anything that gets podcasts. That includes Spotify.
Thanks, folks. We're out.